Okay, we're in the book of Deuteronomy, and it's in the fifth chapter, not very long, and most of the prophets says, yeah, we know what it says. Well, let's find out.
And Moses called all Israel and said to them, Hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your hearing today, that you may learn them and be careful to observe them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, those who are here today. All of us who are alive. The Lord talked with you face to face on the mountain from the midst of the fire. I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord. For you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up the mountain. He said, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image. Any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Observe the Sabbath day, to keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your ox, nor your donkey, nor any of your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. And remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Honor your father and your mother, as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be long, and that it may be well with you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that is in your neighbor's, that is your neighbor's. Those words the Lord spoke to all your assembly, and in the mountain, from the midst of the fire, the cloud, and the thick darkness, with a loud voice, and he added no more. And he wrote them on 2 tablets of stone, and gave them to me. So it was, when you heard the voice from the midst of the darkness, while the mountain was burning with fire, that you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders. And you said, Surely the Lord our God has shown his glory, shown us his glory and his greatness, and we have heard his voice from the midst of the fire. We have seen this day that God speaks with man, yet he still lives. Now therefore, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us. If we hear the voice of the Lord our God any more, then we shall die. For who is there of all flesh who has heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire, as we have, and lived? You go near, and hear all that the Lord our God may say, and tell us all that the Lord our God says to you, and we will hear and do it. Then the Lord heard the voice of your words, when you spoke to me, and the Lord said to me, I have heard the voice of the words of the people which have spoken to you. They are right in all that they have spoken. Oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments, that it might be well with them and might and with their children forever. Go and say to them, Return to your tents. But as for you, stand here by me, and I will speak to you all the commandments, the statutes and the judgments which you shall teach them, that they may observe them in the land which I am giving them to possess. Therefore you shall be careful to do as the Lord your God has commanded you, You shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. You shall walk in all the ways which the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you shall possess.
Since we know what it's all about, should we call it a break? Statutes. Judgments. Commandments. Next week we will learn another word. But that's next week, because another thing that is called that we ought to do as well. Now, when we look at these words, we're familiar with those words, and yet so far in this chapter or in this book, how many statutes have you heard him talk about? How many judgments have you heard him talk about? Statutes. Hakim. The statutes, the plurality of the word statutes is never singular. Judgments. Hamishpatim. Now, before we get any farther on that one, what does judgment relate to? It's direct relation to statutes. Statutes are mentioned first. Judgment. Now, there's something Yahshua had said to the Pharisees. He talked about the law. What were the three things he said? Hope you know it by heart. Judgment, mercy, and faith. Now, when we look at this thing, when someone has done something wrong, what we want, what God has in mind, is something has to be corrected. And it's called judgment. Now, I read to you before, Abraham called the creator of heaven and earth the judge. Now, the word judge comes from someone making a decision. And since he's the judge of the world, that's what Abram said. Remember he said that during the time of Sodom and Gomorrah? And so he went through the cycle of numbering the people. Down, how far down it goes. And there was a number that he said, that's it. And he left. So God has a number. And so we have to say, okay, what is the number? Okay, let's take a look here at statutes. Now, when you think of the word statutes, do you know the core of the meaning of the word statutes? A prescribed task. That's what the basic word in Hebrew is saying when they use the word statutes, or we call laws or ordinances or decrees. It's pre-task. Something had been predetermined, and that's the task. So when we think about trying to understand or do or keep the statutes, we don't come up with our own. We come up with something that's already had been pre-stated, and it is a task, not a law. Now, when we know in our own world, in our own life, when you drive in the freeway, there is a, quote, pre-described task of the speed, isn't it? You didn't determine it. Somebody else determined that pre-described task. That means you have a task to do. When you're on the freeway, your task is to stay within that pre-described. So you understand what I'm saying when you talk to use statutes? Simplicity of a word. I'm trying to make it simple as easy, because that works, right? We all understand that. And so when we look at the statutes of God, we look at what he's saying, they're telling us something about him. Not about you, not about people, not about what is. It's pre-described. He made a task, And he said, this is the task. Bambo, why would he make the task for? David made a statement today. You know, he's trying to explain, I think he did a good job, of what is wisdom. Wisdom comes from knowledge of what? Knowledge of what the task is. And the knowledge of the ability, I should say, if you just know the knowledge, it's of no value. But since it's a task pre-described by the Eternal, and you start doing the task, then what's naturally going to take place? He said the word wisdom. Right? Now, you're not wise because God made you wise. You're wise because you performed a task. And then people can take and look at you and say, oh, this is a wise person. Now, in the fourth chapter, remember, he said that these statutes and these judgments will make you wise and an understanding people. So we know that we look at the statutes, we know this much, that it's going to, when we enact upon them, when we participate with them, when we put them part of our existence, we will perform them, and guess what? People will look around, and they'll say, boy, that person does this. And look at the blessings they have received. Now, not the blessings and wealth, but it could be. But they don't see, what should they see? You are, quote, the Messiah said, the light of the world. What's the easiest method to become a light of the world? Preach the gospel. No. Task. Perform the task that the Eternal pre-described to do. And then they see that. They see the light. They see something happening. And what the book, fourth chapter of Deuteronomy said, they will see a wise and an understanding person. Now, when you start acting on it, because in all you're getting, what are you supposed to get? Understanding. So, that's enough said about the word task. We got a picture, right? It's a lot deeper than just a law. No, it's an action. It's a deed. It's what you do. Then comes the judgments. Okay. When the task that's been pre-described to be done, and you do not do the task, then there forth comes something. And it's called judgment. Now, how do you get out of that judgment? What's the last thing the Messiah said? No, it's the second thing he said. Justice, mercy, and what? Faith. Faith in what? Sometimes we have, in our world, we must have faith. Well, how many times have you heard Jeff say it over and over again in Greek? I've heard me say it many times in English and in Hebrew. It's not talking about my faith in God. It's knowing that God is faithful to do what he said he is going to do. That's why there is fear of the Lord. So when a task takes place and it's not performed, fear should strike us. Then the next thing he says, I'm going to put a judgment against you because you did not perform the task. And your object is to fall? Well, maybe. Your object is to, to repent and start doing the task that was pre-described. Then therefore comes, mercy is coming there because now he says, now you have confidence in me that my task that I have said is good and just and holy. Now you're understanding me. What it says, one of the prophets, right offhand, I can't remember where it's at, forgive me. But he says, blessed is the man who knows me. Now, when it comes to know, what does that mean? Talking earlier with Rose, and I said, it's one thing to say, yeah, I know the Lord. It's like saying, you know, Rose, I know your mother. Really? No. I know who she is, but I don't know what she's like. Don't know what she was like. She's passed, right? Don't know what she's like. Don't know what she did, because she's not part of my life, right? Now, when it comes to know the Lord, that means he's part of your life, like your own flesh and blood mother. You know what your mother thinks. You know what your mother is like. You know what her actions are. You know what her deeds are. You know what she will do and respond. It's the same kind of picture here now in relationship to, oh, I can have confidence that my mother is going to do such and such if, quote, she finds out, I use that terminology, that I didn't fulfill and do what she wanted me to do. We're talking about questioning a little, but you understand what I'm saying so far? So we're looking at these things. We say, okay, now what? The next thing in verse 2 of chapter 5, he comes up with another word. He talks about this Elohim has made a covenant. A barit. Barit. A covenant. Now what does covenant mean? Well, there's a lot of different meanings to it. Basically, it means I made an alliance. I made a pledge. I have made an agreement with you. Now, it has from two different meanings. So there's two different Hebrew words for it. The root word. There are two different root words for this word. One is, strange what it may say, to eat and to consume. That doesn't make sense. Throw it out. What's the other one? It means to create, to shape, and form. Oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense. And then there's another one that says, oh, wait a minute, to purify, to select, to polish, to choose, to... Oh, that works too, right? Now, ask yourself a question. Why, on the very first time, that God made a covenant with the house of Israel, do you remember what took place? Before this one. They had dinner. They sat down and they ate. You remember that? Passover? Pesach? Now, he said, I want you to do this. And they did it. And then now there's a point of God is faithful in his word. What did he say? I will not kill you. Right? So it was an agreement. It was like a covenant, an opening or beginning of a covenant. And it was a agreement, one that was cut, and it cost the life of an animal. But it was an agreement. Now, when we take the Passover sometimes, we just assume we'll do it by tradition. Well, every time we take the Passover, we should realize there's something that was involved in the first place. It was an agreement. You trusted that God would carry out what he said. Yes.
Did you say that the covenant before this mentioned here was the one with Moses and Passover?
Yeah, because of the agreement.
But before that, wasn't Abraham, didn't he have
He says, this covenant we have had.
Oh, okay. So
we're talking to Moses, the time of Moses, the people of Moses. Says this is the covenant that was not given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It was given to us.
Oh, okay.
We who are alive today at the point in time of the writing. So separate yourself from Abraham's covenant. Although he said it was nothing else was added, which has to go into Apostle Paul's writing. I'm not going to go there today. But you understand so far where we're at. And at this point in time in history where they're ready to cross the line, after 40 years being in the wilderness, end of quote, they now are ready to enter. And the first thing he starts telling them is that there was a covenant made with you. And that covenant is did not made, verse 3, with our fathers, but with us. So it also, of course, means to create or to sharp or to form. So there was what happened at Mount Sinai. What was the occasion that took place? The Ten Commandments. Now, in chapter 4, one of the last things that was said in chapter 4 was the words commandments. Do you remember what I said commandments meant in Hebrew? Commandments is not a law in the sense that it's a statute pre-described. What is it? Okay. What chapter? Here we go. A commandment, simply as it is in English, as it is in Hebrew, means I'm giving you a charge. I'm giving you something that you must do. You are now responsible for this charge. No, it's not mitzvot. A different word. Don't get those words confused. Hebrew get those things confused, but it's not a mitzvot. Zavah. Zavah is the word for commandment. Has nothing to do with the word mitzvot. It's a zadi and a vav and a hey. So we're looking at this thing. So now we have to look at this thing and we have to ask ourselves, did God have three things? Well, yeah, so far, right? Statutes, judgment, and commandment. Now he's made a covenant, an agreement with him. All right? And of course, we talk about the fire, the midst of the fire. Verse 6. We know these are the, quote, commandments, but let's look at them for just a moment. He says, I'm using Old English here, I am Yahuwah, thy Elohim, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. It should be a plurality. It should be house of bondages. Because that's what the Hebrew says. It's a house of bondages. Now, what does that word mean? Avarim. Avarim. Avarim means what? Avarim. It means exactly what you think it means. Bondages. The plurality for bondages. And the core of the word is servant. And we kind of translate the word slave. But you remember that the commandment says you were now, quote, I'll use that word slave, you're now slaves to Pharaoh and now you're slaves of mine. Well, in Hebrew, we'll get to the commandment now. Very fascinating commandment when we get into it farther. We'll find out exactly more in detail of what he, the creator of heaven and earth, considers, quote, slaving for him compared to what men think slaving is for them. Basically, the simple breakdown of English, it means you are now to work for somebody else. Now, I know there are people like him, you know, self-employed. The truth is, he's not self-employed. He's working for somebody else. He is in bondage, we're using that terminology. He's in slavery, if you want to use that terminology. He's in service, if you want to use that terminology. But that's not the right word. We'll get to that word in a minute. But when you work for somebody else. This has to do with being serving somebody else. That's the basic word. Now the second word comes in, it's in the fourth commandment. We'll get there in a minute. Verse 7, and it's a very interesting word. Thou shalt have none other Elohim before me. Now, we all understand that, right? What does that mean? What does it say in Hebrew? What is it trying to tell us in Hebrew? We know that word says other. You know what that word is in Hebrew? Ahurim. Ahurim. Which means to cause one to delay. Cause one to be held back. Cause one to stop. So he's telling you another Elohim is going to stop you. He's going to hold you back. He's not going to allow you to continue going where I want you to go. It's a very fascinating terminology in Hebrew. So we're learning some things. And he says, before me. Well, in Hebrew, it means, okay, over or against my face. Don't put any other Elohim in front of my face. They are going to keep you from me. Don't allow another. He doesn't say there are not any others, because there are. Otherwise, you wouldn't use the plurality of the word Elohim in Hebrew. It's a plurality of a world, not a single word, but a plurality. So now we come into the thing and we say, oh, that's fascinating. Don't have anybody over or against my face. I don't want to see it. And God talks about the word jealousy. We hope I get the word jealousy today. It's very fascinating terminology. Find verse 8 very fascinating. If you were one of them, let's say you're there, and Moses is talking to you, and you're the second generation, and there you are, and he's saying these words, quote, didn't word them exactly like it was in the book of Exodus, and what's your problem? So here he says, thou shalt not make thee any graven or carved image of any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or is in the earth beneath, or that is in the waters beneath the earth. Okay, no problem. I understand that one. There are three things here. Did you notice that? There are three. Not one, not two, three. Put it in simple English. You will not have any kindness in heaven, which is above thee, or the earth, which is beneath thee, because you're standing on the earth, or where the waters were beneath the earth. Wait a minute. What about the other things he said in the fourth chapter? Fourth chapter, he added what else? What else did he add in the fourth chapter, remember? After he mentioned these three in the fourth chapter, now he mentions something else. The sun, the moon, the stars, and the host of heaven. Oh, that's four. So we have a twofold thing. One is our atmosphere, our world we live in, where we're at, and the other one's way beyond our reach. Well, we've reached the moon. Yeah, right? How many times have you gone to the moon now? Once, maybe twice. That's about it. Can't live there. It's no value. So nothing there to go for. Now, he says, you shall not bow thyself down, verse 9, for I am thy Elohim, am a jealous. Oh, we don't like that word, do we? I'm jealous of you. right? We don't like those words. Or, I'm envy of you. We don't like those words, do we? God, is it that way? Let me tell you something. This word for us called jealousy only applies to God and only to God in the entire Torah. Doesn't apply to human beings. This word is addressing of God, the Creator. Yes, Dave, I'm sorry, Jeff.
Whoever that guy is.
Yeah, brother Dave. Yeah.
One of the negative connotations that comes from jealousy is the irrationality of jealousy. It's an irrational rage that prompts people to want to cling on to something. Now, that, when you look in the context of God, is obviously doesn't apply, because he has a very rational reason for wanting to hang on to us, since he created us.
To put this in a simple English terminology, everywhere you find that word in Hebrew, it always refers to God, the creator of heaven and earth. Every single time. No human being can do this. No human being can reach that point. The simplicity of the matter is, because he says, I am a jealous God, he says, I am not going to bear or have no other rival. There is no other that can rival against me. And if you bring forth another human Elohim, it's not going to work, because I am going to not allow that, because in my world, I will not have any rival. Now, what did God do to the house of Egypt? I destroyed the Elohim of Egypt. All of the Elohim of Egypt. No rival. You understand what I'm saying? So when he says to you, beware, you bring forth another Elohim, whether it's stone, the sun, the earth, water, whatever it is, you bring forth, he's going to be against you. Simple as that. And how does God get rid of an idol? He destroys it. Literally destroys it. It doesn't come back. It's over with. The end of the story. So when you think of the word jealousy, think of it as there is no other rival. Now, he goes on. He says, however, there's something else. In verse 10, after all that powerful statement, he says, you know, but I do show mercy. What does mercy mean in Hebrew? Sorry, what? No. That's WWG's message. That's not what it says here. You don't know what I'm talking about. That's another church organization that had a different interpretation of what that word means. All right, I don't go there, because that's not the right meaning. Let's talk about what the meaning says. It is not forgiveness. Forgiveness is a different word in Hebrew. This is mercy. Chasad. Which means to be good, to be kind, and to show kindness. Ooh. I mean, I have to sin and transgress before he shows me kindness? No. Kindness is there all the time. And if you love me, I'm going to show something to you. I'm going to show you kindness. So when the Messiah says, three of the great things, justice, mercy, first thing he says is kindness. He's going to show kindness. And here we have it in Scripture, where when we read the verse 9, where he is furious and angry, He's going to visit the iniquities of the father upon the children of the third and fourth generation. Is that mercy? Is it mercy? Is it kindness? Oh, no. It's not. He's not going to show that. He's going to show something else called jealousy in Hebrew. Rival. You're rivaling against God. Are you going to win? Yes.
I have my little cheat sheet here. And it talks about the word hesed. And one of the meanings for it, or at least one of the translations for it, is deeds of devotion or devotion. So it got me thinking a little bit, is that when you like somebody, when you love someone, whenever they walk into the room, you get a smile on your face. You know, when a man is falling in love with a woman, he wants to give her flowers, he wants to do nice things for her, open the door for her, make sure that, you know, he wants to take care of her. And when we are in that relationship with God, when we have that hesed relationship with God, rather than the rivalry or jealousy relationship with God, because we set up an idol in our hearts that is against him, but when we're in that hesed relationship with God, he wants to bless us, you know, and
that's
to show us devotion.
I'm glad you
just like we show him devotion.
Do you understand what she said? Okay? It's not an either or. It's this or that. You're either going to have rival with me. If you love me, oh, I'm going to do this to you. So we don't want God on our, against us, right? We have to be on God's side, not God on our side. Yes, Jeff.
The root verb that chesed comes from is chasad, which comes from the sense of bowing, to bow the neck. Which is really interesting, because God says he's described as the lifter of our heads. So in other words, to be able to have someone bow, kind of in a sense of bowing, acknowledging kindness and affirmation and such, towards someone, the other person can't have their head down. So okay, God lifts our heads up. And thus,
but also, Scripture also says, I will bow down to you. I'll bend down to you, deliver you. I'm coming down to save you. God is not an arrogant one. He's not an arrogant one. Doesn't have arrogancy. The Messiah, what did the Messiah do that kind of tells us, because he says, I am like my Father. What did the Messiah do to his disciples? He had to bow down to wash their feet. And it's pretty hard for us to picture the Creator of our Father bowing down to wash our feet. No, he would never do that. He's too great. Well, Peter said that about Yahshua, right? You'll never wash my feet. You're too great. You're too awesome. If you do that, you're no part of me. Pretty heavy stuff, right? So you don't want to do that with God. So come back here on this particular thing about the commandment. We read the part of, okay, he's not, don't want any other rivalry. And up comes, and this is written different here in the book of Deuteronomy. And he says, you know, but I'm going to be kind to thousands of them that love me. And do one more thing. Keep my commandments. Didn't we just talk about commandments? Didn't say laws here. It says commandments. You know, the Ten Commandments, if you really, all truthfulness, if you or I can follow those orders and institute those orders in our lives constantly on a daily basis, we're on the other side where God says, oh, I think I like you. We'll get to the word love here in a minute. If it's here in this chapter, maybe the next chapter, I don't know. And the next one, Sabbath day, okay, and to sanctify it or keep it holy. Some translate it to observe it. There's a word that's, two words are in here, and most people are aware of them, but they don't know exactly what it means. One is the word translated in English, labor. The other one that's translated in English is work. Now, we drop down to the 14th chapter, and it says, but the seventh day is the Sabbath, and Yahuwah the Elohim, and in it thou shalt do no work. Well, what about labor? All right. Now, God brought the children of Israel out of the house of, which is the house of servants. Literally, that's what it translates to be. Out of the house of slaves. You want to use that word. Now, we see that very same word here, when it comes to the word labor, and it comes to the word work. The word labor here is that word for to serve, like you are working for someone else. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's why I went back to the very beginning and tried to explain what it means. So the moratorium is not on serving somebody else. The moratorium is on the other word called work. What does that word mean? You've heard me say it before, so I'm going to say it again. What is the Hebrew word for an angel? What's a melech? What does he do? No. He's a messenger. He's to represent it. He's a form. He has a job to do. Angels don't rest upon the Shabbat. They work. And basically the English means the word for work is an occupation. What you do for work to bring in quantity, bring in money, or to bring in a business form. That's the moratorium. That's the one he said, I don't want you to do that. Now, you understand what I'm saying so far? The two different meanings in Hebrew. One is labor, meaning serving something or serving someone else. I talked about Dave serving. Now, when he serves somebody else, that's different. When he works for somebody else, different meaning in Hebrew. He is not to work on the Sabbath, but he can serve on the Sabbath. Who's he going to serve? You, me. He doesn't get paid for it. It's not his livelihood. How much money do you make doing this? He gets nothing for it. And this is a very fascinating thing. Let's continue on with this commandment. Very latter part of it. It says about all the maidservants, the manservants, and all the people in your gates, and so forth. It says they may rest. You know what the word rest means in Hebrew? Yeah, what does it mean? Settle down, have a rest, take a break, and be restful and quit. Literally quit. We have that phrase, one of the songs we have, not song, opening song, is the Lord was refreshed. Kind of same kind of terminology. He was refreshed. He was settled down. He stopped working. Remember? Day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, day six. Then he stopped. But now he gives a different reason for doing it. Did you catch this in the 15th chapter? So remember that thou were, and there's the word, laborer, a servant, in the land of Egypt, that Yahuwah thy Elohim brought you out from there, and so on and so forth. Then he says the word, therefore, Yahuwah the Elohim commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. Did you catch that? Therefore. Debate about two words. El or El, which can mean concerning or because of this, because of that matter. And the other part is Con. It means be firm and be stable. Therefore, because of this, be firm and be stable. Be firm and be stable. What does that mean? What happened to you, he says, and what I did for you, the reason why you should do this to your cattle, to the people that work for you, that do hard work for you 6 days a week, is because of you. You're the reason. Now, we're not there at this point in time in this particular section, but remember it says there that the Sabbath was to be something between the house of Israel and God, a sign. So when we do the Sabbath, we do this, it's going to be a picture of something. What is the picture about? You taking a break? What is a picture? Now, this is an open question, by the way. What do you think it pictures? Why would he say it's a picture or a symbol or a something between me and you? Why did he, just because he just created the seventh day? Remember, he created the seventh day for man. We know what Yeshua said. But why is it a sign? Why is it a picture? What's supposed to tell us? What's supposed to tell the world? What's supposed to say to the world anything at all?
It says he is our God and we are his people.
That works. And the other comment. David. I mean, who are you, Donald?
Whoever that guy is, yes.
Jeff.
Well, the two places where it does say is to the reasons for it, you know, in Exodus 20 and elsewhere here, is that, you know, number one, he's the creator. He's the one who created things. But also, it says that he's the one who took us out of Egypt. So when you combine those two, he's the one who created everything. So that's where the allegiance should be for everybody. But also, he's the one who took us out of our false taskmasters and directed us to the one who we should be getting our orders from.
All right. How does it affect you today? Has not God taken you out of something? Taken you out from another Elohim that you were servants to? And brought you into him? And what kind of lordship does he have? You see the picture? It's telling us something. God called every one of us out from where we were once. Not just Israel, but where we were once. Now, I know that some of you probably grew up being a Seventh-day Adventist, or maybe you've been a Jew, always said stuff, but it doesn't really tell you. You're kind of like, okay, it's what I got to do. It had no relationship to God. That's the church that did it. Oh, wait a minute. Back off. This has nothing to do with the church and God. It has to do with God and you. Period. And so when we have this sign, this picture is revealing something, telling us that, wow, God really did do what he did to me as he did to them. Does that make sense to you? You see a picture? Let's take a little more time. Is that 2:30? 2:35. I'm not going to be too much longer. I'll go through the word honor. We kind of both know that. The word kill in Hebrew literally means to murder. Literally means to dash somebody in pieces. I mean, you're going out there doing something horrible. Let's drop down to verse 21. I find it funny because when he read this in the New King James Version, it's just the opposite in the Old King James Version. That's interesting. It says, thou shalt not, and he used the word covet. And later on, neither shall you, didn't use the word covet, he used the word desire. In Hebrew, it's the other way around. Now, you shall not desire thy neighbor's wife. What does that mean? To take pleasure in and to delight in your neighbor's wife. That's an action you're doing. Ooh, that's different than saying, oh man, I wish she knew me. No, you're playing a little game here. The first thing he names in this commandment is the woman. It wasn't secondary thought. It wasn't also. It was first thing he named is, don't do this. Don't have not a desire. Thou is the word for desire. But do not take pleasure in or delight in your neighbor's wife. Now we're told to delight on the Shabbat, right? Good word there. Delight. Delight. But here, and then he goes on and he says, thou shalt not covet. Now, covet is a little different. That does mean, in a sense, we turn it into word desire, but it means to wait longingly, wish and sigh, want and to be greedily preferred. Now, that's a little bit different than taking pleasure in thy neighbor's wife. It's almost like committing adultery, isn't it? Being aware, that's what it's almost close to. What does Messiah say? You look upon a woman, you're taking pleasure in your neighbor's wife. Ah, that's not a good one. And then the one to covet, don't desire. Now, there was a certain king. Who was his name? What was his name?
David.
I'm sorry, what?
David.
Huh? He had a wife who was a Phoenician. Her name was Jezebel. All right. Now, he did something. He coveted the neighbor's what? Property, his grapes. He wanted it. But he didn't have, we would call it, the guts to do it. Because he knew what the law said. Okay. And so what did his wife do? He killed him. No. The guy got the property. So that's what that refers to. Longing in the sense of longing and waiting patiently or waiting impatiently, how you want waiting for. And to prefer somebody else's property. Somebody else's belongings. Somebody else's belongs to somebody else. Not just the wife here. Wife named first, but has to do having pleasure in. This one is wanting what he has. Okay. Let's relate to that city, modern times. I'm being really honest with you. I don't have the answers. But when somebody's in financial trouble and they're in real financial trouble, and their house now is up for grabs. There is no saying, let's help this person out. The first thing that someone does, I mean, you could do it yourself, get online. Oh, I can make a lot of money now, this house. That guy only holds that much. I'm buying it. You're beginning to covet after your neighbor's house. And you take advantage of it. Not with the word of God. You stick at your neighbor and say, oh my, is there anything I can do to help you? I can't afford to buy your house for you. I can't do that. Unless you're a very wealthy man, you're a kind man, a gentle man, you can say, I got to buy this house, and I'm going to continue on living in it, and all you have to do is finish paying off. I won't charge you the huge 3,000% interest or whatever the interest is, you know. I will just have you pay me back. And of course, with the word of God, if you don't do it in 7 years, that's okay. Wow. Now that's a just and upright and a man who is, quote, performing the task that was pre-described. You got to consider that's an awesome human being that could do that, right? All right. Any more statements? Any more questions? I'm about to end it on this section. We're about to have to almost call it quits pretty soon. Open. Please, talk. This lady is never afraid to ask questions.
Did you say you were going to describe what honor is? Or the honor of the father and mother?
That's in Hebrew, it's a little confusing. I'll be honest with you. It comes from a verb. That's very unusual terminology. And it means to be heavy. Honor thy father and thy mother. To be heavy. I mean your mother is heavy and your father is heavy, or you're heavy. What does heaviness mean? Jeff, I got your name right.
Good. Well, you know, there is that saying about placing a lot of weight in what someone says. And that comes from the sense of a scale, meaning that what someone has to contribute to a scale would weigh down further in their favor. So
Yes. When
I guess you compare your parents to any other contribution or any other situation, theirs should weigh down the scale
further.
Yeah,
because the next meeting is, listen to what he said, now the next meeting is to be weighty, of value. So what he said in here is that, yeah, it's heavy, but it's also weighty. It's of great value. When you put gold on a scale, gold is heavy. And it should be of value and worth something. And the next one is to be gracious. Now, that's a little bit different meaning. What do you think gracious means? Well, self-explanatory, right? I hope. What does it mean to be gracious to thy father and thy mother? Gracious means what? Kindness. Doesn't mean merciful. Gracious does not mean... Okay, I'll put it this way. I'm going to stumble on this one, okay? That person is a gracious person. What does that mean to you? They have significant value because they are gracious. Humble. Respectful. Honorable, huh?
I would think you step aside.
Except what? I'm sorry.
Step aside.
Well, yes. You could put it that way. That works. You've given them the honor because they are gracious people. And you're being gracious in turn by doing the very same thing to your mom and your dad. Another meaning is, well, we don't have to go any farther than that. But you understand what I'm saying. It has to do with also has to do with being a burdensome. Pretty odd word. Why would it say honor your father and your mother, burden your father and your mother? What do you think it means? Your father and mother has a burden, and gently as you. You should honor them because they held that burden for how many years? Sometimes we think it's, only my teenage years. Well, sometimes it goes into the age 20, 30, 40, 50. It may go on for quite a while. All right? So, yes, you should honor them because they hold a burden. And they don't complain about it. Hopefully, a good mom and dad would not. Yes.
Richard, could you explain, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain? Mean it to cuss, or does that mean to use his name unlawfully? I really would like a good explanation of that.
That was in commandment number. Seventh day. Vain. It's a very fascinating word in Hebrew. It derives from two different words that got spelled a little bit different, but they're both the same kind of mean. It means what we think to consider to be worthlessness and to be nothingness. And so when he says, when you take my name in vain, you are putting my name to, literally in Hebrew, to ruin. You're putting my name to a pile of junk, crap. Right? It's a big difference. That's basically the core of the Hebrew word when it says in vain. It doesn't mean empty of worthlessness. It means, yeah, you acknowledge it, but it's really full of nothing. It's of no value. And it does not mean just an oath. This commandment is not based upon an oath. This commandment is based upon the name. Does that explain you a little bit there? It has to do that you are emptiness, vanity, of falsehood. Okay. You're still emptying. You're making the word, the name of God, worthless. You're making the name of God crappy. Put in simple English. Jeff.
Well, one of the things that's a bit helpful is to look at the phrase in Hebrew as it is about taking his name in vain. Because take comes from a word, the yishah, which means to lift or to carry or such. So when you combine it with the Hebrew word there for vain, of shu, which is to destroy or to make empty or that kind
right.
of thing, you know, you combine it with the thought that you're lifting or carrying it in such a way that it gets destroyed. So you think of it as like the proverbial bull in a china shop, that you're careless and reckless in what you do in such a way that there's destruction that results at the end of it. So in a sense, that you're carrying, you're bearing the name of God in such a way that it gets destroyed or tainted.
Now, the Apostle Paul used a different phrase.
Yeah.
What did he say? About...
Oh yes, the name of the Lord is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Yeah,
that's pretty heavy stuff, isn't it? Now, are you thinking that the people that the Apostle Paul were with, that those Jews used God's name in profanity, or were they using His name this way, worthlessness, emptiness of no value? That's why we have to be careful when we use a title, a description, whatever you want to call it, of the Creator of heaven and earth. It should be something you should be terrified of, because he said, you're innocent. No, he says, you're guilty.
Because, you know, we do have that sense today of name being more than just what you physically say, in that it also bears reputation as well.
Correct.
So that when people think of Richard, when they hear it, Richard Agee, they should know something about you from your name. Because beyond, okay, when they hear your name, there's a reputation, there's history and such that goes into that. So,
well, I understand what you're saying, yeah.
So, for example, you know, if I was to go out and turn the name of Richard Agee into a curse word that people got angry every time they heard it, because, oh man, worthless Richard Agee. So what I have done is I have now destroyed your name. Your name now has become a sense of disgust. So in that sense, going out and claiming to be a follower of the Lord, the God of Israel, and acting in a way that's completely uncharacteristic with God's history and what He's claiming to do, now when people hear that name, you've now just taken that whole history and reputation of God and destroyed it.
And we probably should keep that in mind with other human beings, period, too. Don't take somebody's name and profane it, to be honest with you. Yes?
There was a brilliant general in the Revolutionary War that was highly acclaimed, and then he turned sides, and his name was Benedict Arnold. And to this day, if a person's a Benedict Arnold, It doesn't remember all the glory of his great general.
He was once one of those
brilliant.
In fact, Washington considered him a better general than himself. The man was able to go to war and fight and win and win and win and win. Well, we're not talking about that issue. We say, well, at that point in time, before when someone does evil against you, you're not supposed to hold any grudges. Remember, that's how you love your neighbor as yourself. Don't hold grudges. Well, that didn't happen with him. He held the grudge forever, and it destroyed him, wiped him out, ceased to be a man of honor, ceased to be a man of success. That's another story altogether, but nonetheless, that's a good example, Ellie. I didn't even think about when Jeff was talking about that. Any more thoughts? I hope we... this is just the Ten Commandments being again, you know, and going over them again. In the latter part of that chapter, last part of that chapter, I didn't go over in detail, but there's something that's very interesting about some of the things that I was said. And that is, but God was speaking to Moses at the time of Shavuot. And he said something. Remember what he said? Oh, if there were a heart in them. In our world now, because he said he was not going to lead us the way he led them. Now he's going to lead us by putting his laws, his pre-tasked statements into our minds. And when that is completed, the next task would be in our hearts. That's where we get understanding. He talks about being in your heart. It means now you understand. Now you know me. Now you understand me. It takes a while. Yes.
Which is why the next chapter starts out with the greatest commandment.
Yeah, well, next chapter, yeah. I think the book of Deuteronomy, in one sense, we have had statutes coming through. The biggest statute is, what was the very first thing he said in the fourth chapter? Let's not call it statutes. Let's call it something else. But remember what he said in the first chapter? You shall not add the word, not words, the word that I command you. Neither shall you diminish, make it null and void, unimportant, insignificant, of no value, of emptiness from it. But you shall keep the commandments of Yahuwah, your Elohim, which I command you today. Do you think that's a very powerful statement? That's what this whole book is all about, by the way. If you want to know what the book of Deuteronomy is all about, it's not repetition of the same thing. No. It's building up of it and making it stronger and stronger and stronger. How many times do I say the word stronger? Chapter after chapter after chapter after chapter. You think God has something to say to us in the book of Deuteronomy? He said a lot of things, didn't he? He gave us a lot of warnings in the fourth chapter. If you have not read the fourth chapter, take home and read it and see the warnings, see the warnings, and see the warnings. They are Devarim, Elohim. And we are to live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of Elohim. Don't diminish it. Don't make it insignificant. Don't make it unimportant. Don't make it something, well, yeah, and that's for somebody else to do, but not me. No, it's there for us.